Hey, Mama, you don't have time to be messing around endlessly scrolling to find a caregiver for your child. Let me clue you in to my trick to save time and my sanity when finding a sitter. SitterCity.com. SitterCity knows what they're doing. They've been helping busy parents find the perfect sitter for over 20 years. While other sites overwhelm you by throwing hundreds of random profiles your way, SitterCity matches you with caregivers who actually fit your needs. No endless scrolling, no guesswork. I love that all caregivers undergo ID verification. They have background checks, specialized qualifications, and real parent reviews to know if they showed up on time or really know how to handle my sassy toddler. And if I need help, I can talk to a real live human, not a robot, with SitterCity's delightful team. You know, my employer pays for me to get SitterCity completely free as part of my benefits. Yours could too. SitterCity is my go-to for a smarter, simpler way to find reliable, trustworthy care. Don't wait. Go to SitterCity.com/XX and get the help you need.
As we can Retronauts, hit the nuke button. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Retronauts. Another episode. That's what this is. We're talking about video games, talking about a video game. And actually, this is another one of those episodes where we're going to let the person who made the game talk about the game. It's much more informative than us bozos here, just speculating and guessing. But we're going to do some of that too. You're going to get the best or worst of both worlds. That's the Retronauts difference. I am Jeremy Parrish. And with me this week to talk about the video game Lemmings, which will be explicated on by one Mike Daly, who made the game, unlike us. Who are you guys who did not make the game?
I definitely didn't make this game. I'm Ben Elgin, just walking over the cliff like the rest of us.
I'm Chris Sims, and Lemmings don't actually do that.
It's true.
And I'm Ben Jedwards.
And he has nothing pithy
and
to say.
I have nothing pithy to say.
Oh, he's a... It's not so much of a lemming as a...
I'm the commander.
You're like the minor bird here.
I'm in charge.
I feel like if you're the commander, you're going to be the one saying things first instead of echoing them back. Yeah, see? Anyway, so lemmings...
I ought to start my own podcast one of these days.
Yeah, you tried that, didn't you?
Oof, talk about the nuke button!
I just died inside a little bit, man.
I'm so sorry. People keep calling me. Stop it, people leaving voicemails in Chinese. No, seriously, I get so many voicemails in Chinese because I have a San Francisco area code. Uh-huh. And like every few weeks I get just like people, I think, telling me like to pay my taxes or something. I don't know. Or like, come pay your bail. I don't know. I'm in trouble in San Francisco is what I'm saying with the triad. But anyway, that's not relevant to this episode.
So if you have a voicemail lemming, how does that help you finish
I don't know. You ignore it for a week until you realize, oh, I got to listen to this. So Lemmings was a computer game released in the early 90s by a company called Psygnosis, which was the publisher for a developer called DMA Design. And they made cool stuff in Scotland and eventually became Rockstar North, who now makes Grand Theft Auto. This game is very different than Grand Theft Auto. Why are you touching it with you're touching a diskette and the... Oh, no, don't do that.
I feel like Bench has brought us the original diskette.
Bench has never handled a diskette before.
Well, not
it's
the original
terrible.
Ones, but... All right. First for Amiga,
if you're a pro
right?
like me, you can touch it without any damage, such as this.
Oh, no. Okay. All right. Anyway, so... Yes, Lemmings. I feel like this is going horribly off the rails.
I've never actually looked at the Lemmings manual. So I brought the...
Now you know how to play. It's great.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I guess it's so intuitive you don't need the manual.
But... So Benj, tell us, how do you play Lemmings? What happens here?
You play as the Grand Overlord looking at the screen.
You play as God, basically.
Yeah. You're commanding... The Lemmings come out of a door... I think, right?
A portal
facing downward. And
they drop onto the landscape.
You have to change their jobs, basically, to get them through the puzzle of the board to a goal. And they can dig or float down or explode or
build. Like steps.
Yeah, steps. Or they can. Some can dig straight down. Some can dig diagonally. Some can, build steps diagonally. Some can breakthrough rock or something.
And then you've got the blockers that are important. They just like make them go the other way. Make ones bounce off and go the other way.
So you have to, your goal is, it's a stage-based puzzle game. Each stage you have to solve the challenges to get to the goal by reassigning jobs to these little lemmings. So they can work together to get as many as you can to the goal without dying.
Well, you have like a quota, don't you?
Yeah, you need
a certain number of lemmings to actually get in the goal, and then the rest are expendable. Although I guess you get bonus points if you get more than the quota.
Yep, and my brother got this box game, IBM 3.5-inch disc in the 1991, around the time it was new. And hey, it has a DMA Design logo on the back. I didn't notice that before.
What does that look like?
Well, it's a couple guys, like a spaceman and a barbarian, looking at each other.
Is it David Jones and Mike Dale?
In a red jelly bean, kind of.
Huh. Wacky.
It's like Grand Theft Auto. And so there's something timeless about this design that allowed it to be ported to something like 20 different systems.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's interesting because Lemmings is very much a game designed around a mouse-driven interface. Like, it's, you know, you have up to 100 little things on the screen, and you have a panel of icons, and you're constantly like switching icons and clicking on characters and giving them commands. But it showed up on all kinds of systems that did not use a mouse interface, like the NES and Game Boy.
It was originally on Amiga, right?
I think so.
I believe it was on Amiga. Right. And there was actually a two-player mode that took advantage of the fact that you could plug two mice into an Amiga and have two people each controlling their own like lemming army at the same time.
That's pretty rad.
Did not make it to most of the consoles because there would just be no way to do it.
Yeah, I feel like Lemmings is a lot more difficult to play with a D-pad than it is with a joystick, but it still works. You know, the game has to be slightly modified for the change in formats, but the concept translates really well, and it really goes back to kind of the PC-based puzzle games that you saw in the early 80s. You know, it's very much about like, here's a lot of, you know, little factors you have to judge and keep in mind, and things can go horribly wrong and you'll have to start over immediately. It's very unforgiving, but there's such a great personality to the game. Chris, I don't know. You've been kind of quiet. Have you played much of Lemmings?
I find Lemmings to be incredibly stressful, not like in a fun way. Like something about the problem solving that you have to employ in Lemmings is way beyond or way different than what my skill set is. So I find it intensely stressful, which is probably the intent, but it freaks me out.
Well, I think it's supposed to be like whimsical fun for a while, and then the difficulty level ramps up. And, you know, people got really good at this game, and the designers got really devious. And so they released a lot of expansions where it was just like, you know, experts only, you jump in and you're basically, all your lemmings are being slaughtered from the word go. Where that's not really the case. Like, the game has a very kind of gentle difficulty curve where it teaches you, like, how do you use a blocker? How do you use a digger? Et cetera, et cetera. So it kind of rolls out new abilities gradually over time and escalates the complexity. But I understand, like, I'm not a fan of dealing with, you know, like, multitasking in video games in real time. Like, strategy games don't do a lot for me. So Lemmings it's not a real-time strategy game, but it's kind of cut from the same cloth.
So like in terms of the skills that it requires, it's along the road to that. And actually when I was looking at this, I read somewhere that, some of the guys that made Warcraft actually took some inspiration from Lemmings, and it's really the same, you know, stuff's happening in real time and you have to be keeping track of what various units are doing all at once and be changing what they're doing on the fly and assigning them. In that respect, it's sort of the same.
Having worked in management, that's too much like real life, and I hate it. Like,
it's stressful.
That's the least favorite part of work for me is managing lots of different things all over the place. It's nice to be able to just, you know, drill down and focus on a few things at once, or like one thing, and just do it to the best of your ability. Lemmings doesn't allow you to do that. So
you are basically a lemming in life.
I guess, sure.
You just do one thing.
A lot of different
except
things.
I don't think I have a nuke button.
Yeah.
upcoming interview that we're about to hear in only a few moments. Do you ask why the lemmings in this game look like that?
He does talk about that, yes.
Okay, good.
Mr. Daly does explain it.
It was originally like some demo walk cycle he was doing, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the characters, he'll go into this in detail in the interview segment, but the characters started out as, like, yeah, basically based on a demo. And the demo was very large characters, not designed for this game, but they were basically like these like robots or something, and they could stomp around. And then there were these like little tiny people that would run around trying to escape from the robots. And they just kind of took the little people sprites that he created. And, you know, I think they're like 6 or 8 pixels tall, but they're amazingly mm-hmm. expressive mm-hmm. considering how tiny they are. There's so much personality. That's a really big part of Lemming's success, is that even though these characters are just a few pixels tall, like, they still have, they do stuff. Like, they have little animations where their heads turn and their hair like waves out behind them. And, you know, whenever you hit the nuke button, they all kind of hunker down and they put their hands over their heads and then they explode. So yeah, there's just like a, it packs a lot of personality into these very tiny characters, and it's great because the characters are so small on screen, and the screens themselves are just like, you know, these huge kind of rock structures. I don't know. It's an impressive kind of feat. If you're wondering about why they're the colors they are, I don't know. It's kind of like the Joker. It's weird.
They're sick and twisted.
Because, mm-hmm. you know, real lemmings are, they're like
brown.
Yes, but they're like hedgehogs.
Right.
Which are also not blue.
Right. Yeah. Nice. Lots of creative liberties taken with color palettes in video games. I am personally looking forward to the Lemmings video game where, or the Lemmings movie adaptation where Jim Carrey plays the Overlord, and it's going
to
be great.
I want you to look at these lemmings and picture them with human teeth.
Oh, God.
Can I not? Is that okay?
I am now, so all no, of you have to. No,
I don't no, think I they refuse. Have mouths.
No, they don't.
Canonically.
Well, maybe the teeth will just grow outside.
Oh, yeah. They're just a nose with eyes. A big nose with a green head. A yes. green hair.
I think it's called a snout.
Snout.
Yes. But I think that's another thing that was intriguing about this game, is that you're saying the levels are just these like big static, like kind of naturalistic.
Sort of.
Terrain.
And then you get to like the hell levels where there's
well,
gouts of fire
blasting
out.
They get to really weird things.
Yeah, there's some where there's columns and things.
Yeah,
and
but a lot of, but like one of the cool things is so you have all this terrain, and it's just, you know, it's just this big, it's not even necessarily, it doesn't really look like tile sets. It just looks like this one big bitmap of this cool terrain, but then you can do stuff to it. So like, instead, yeah. this was an era when like destructible terrain was still like a really cool thing. And so you can, you know, you can dig through it and you can blow it up. And it's just, it makes you think that there's all these different possibilities of like how you could tackle a given level, which sometimes there are. And I don't know if the developer talks about this in the interview, but he was saying, you know, they were beta testing levels and they'd have this like, things set up where you're supposed to have do all this complicated stuff, and then someone else looks at it and like, oh, but you can just dig through here instead and bypass all that.
Mm.
Yeah.
And the like that kind of like emergent behavior is like really interesting in the game, especially back in this era when there wasn't a lot that was that complicated to allow you these kind of multiple options.
Are there lemming speedrunners, you think?
Oh, I'm sure.
Probably. I mean, there's got to be.
Try to beat it as fast as possible.
I mean, there has to have been a lemmings playthrough at ADQ at some point.
I'm sure.
I would be shocked if not. Chris, are you looking that up right now?
I am looking it up right
Good
now.
Good man.
I think.
Oh, yeah.
What's the world record?
Yeah, what's the world record?
42 minutes, 45 seconds.
For the whole
first game.
For the MSOs.
That's a lot of condensed stress, honestly.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I am, speaking of stress, I mean, I'm the same with Chris, where it does get really stressful for me. I can play the first 10 levels or something, and then it's like just too much to manage and overwhelming, and I kind of want to stop. But there's other
lemmings
people who
die.
Yeah, I mean, well, you have to make all those decisions quickly and figure out which one's which. And then it's like, have you ever, this is a similar, like, have you ever turned on a video game, started it and left it sitting there while your guy just gets beaten up and dies? Like you walk away from it. I can't stand that. Like if you like start a game of like, I don't know, like Altered Beast or something. And the guy's just sitting there and then just gets beaten up and killed. Does that ever happen to you? I turned it on because you're about to test a joystick that you just built and designed yourself.
Okay, see, this is a pretty specific scenario.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
Pretty specific
yeah, as one does.
To you.
But I'm just saying, like, I can't stand this to step away and let that happen.
Yeah,
and
I don't
similar
usually
feeling,
turn on
like
a game unless I'm
going to
play it. Is the
in fact,
I think this is all you.
Yeah, it's a bigger thing in my life. This powerlessness, this control issues, this Yeah, this is therapy.
Well, yeah.
Is this where you turn into a villain, Binge?
Yeah.
I do feel like Lemmings... over here. I feel like Lemmings presses the Tetris button in people's brains. But for me and for Binge, apparently, like, there's a fine line between, like, the kind of fast movement and quick decision-making that is appealing versus the way more complicated stuff that you're dealing with in Lemmings, which is cool, but it gets to a point where I can't.
Micromanage.
I feel like it's probably it's a number of decisions at once threshold. It's like Tetris, you're dealing with one piece, whereas with this or with an RTS, you can quickly get to a point where you're trying to manage like five different positions at once.
Like, well, which is weird, because I actually really, like, I haven't played them in a while, but I, you know, I played Warcraft 3 like a year ago, and I enjoy RTS games.
It seems like the same kind of skill set to me.
I think it's the same, too.
But I think there's something about, like, the simplicity of telling someone to go hit something, as opposed to...
But you can group them.
Yeah,
you can do a big group and do this.
Yeah, so, you know, our next topic is actually an RTS, so why don't we table this discussion on Lemmings and let Mike Daly inform us, you know, the inside story on creating Lemmings. And we'll move along to the next episode, which you guys at home will hear in about a month. So look forward to that. Thank you, folks, for talking about Lemmings. And I don't know what happened at the beginning there. Sorry. And this is another episode of Retronauts, and it's another special episode of Retronauts because I'm at Game Developers Conference, and just like last year, I'm talking to cool people. And first, the first cool person I have here is Mike Daly, who worked with DMA Designs and helped design Lemmings and some other games you may have heard of.
Yep. Hi. How you doing?
So, Mike, you're giving a presentation this year at GDC, correct?
Yeah, I'm doing a classic game postmortem on Lemmings.
Okay. So I definitely want to talk to you about Lemmings, but I'd also like to, you know, kind of go a little further back than that and just talk about kind of your entry into game design and, you know, just the UK gaming scene in general. That's something that I've always had an outsider perspective on, having grown up in America. So, you know, like, I definitely was familiar with Psygnosis games. I know that you worked on some of those.
Yeah.
So I would see games like Lemmings and Shadow of the Beast, and, like, they had this kind of... I don't know, like an ineffable alien quality to them. They didn't seem like, you know, the Nintendo games I was used to playing. So it's always been kind of a source of fascination to me. But again, like I said, I'm kind of an outsider. So I'm curious, like, how did you kind of get into game development, and, you know, kind of what were your early sort of formative gaming experiences?
I mean, the UK was vastly different from the US, because the US was pretty much console based. The UK, we didn't really do much of consoles. It was all kind of home computers. We had a ZX Spectrum, Commodore 64 were the main ones. So I started probably when I was about 13. I managed to buy a friend's ZX81, which is the precursor to the Spectrum. Mm-hmm. I had that for a couple of years, and then I got hold of a Spectrum for about a year. My mum's work was wanting a database written, so I wrote them a database and managed to get a Spectrum for a while. After that, I got a Commodore Plus 4. I was still pretty much just on my own learning myself. But it was about that time I went to a computer club. They were springing up all over the place back then, mostly to copy games, as to be said. but I did manage to meet Steve Hammond, Russell Kay, and Dave Jones there. And we were all more interested in writing games and doing things with it rather than just playing games. So that was about 85. So from then, the kind of four of us really just kind of hung out and made different games. None of them really got finished. They were all kind of half games, which was kind of good fun. So we'd just go home from school and just go on the computer and make things. About, what would it have been, 88, Dave really managed to finish a game first, basically. He had his Amiga that he got as redundancy package from Timex. Timex were the place that made the Spectrum. So he'd been working there. He got a redundancy package there and went to university, but he bought an Amiga with it. So in 88, he managed to finish his first game, which was Menace, on the Amiga. And then he started writing his second one, which was Blood Money. But about the same time, he also got contracts from Psygnosis to do ports of games. So he offered me a port of Ballistics, which was an ST Amiga game, to take on the Commodore 64. And I kind of jumped at the chance to become a kind of professional developer at that point.
Yeah, Ballistics was like a top-down sports game, right?
It was like the Ricochet with the marbles, where you shoot the marbles at and try to fire a puck into a goal. Mm-hmm. So it was a digital version of that, basically. Mm-hmm. So there was a two-player version where it was just you were firing balls at this thing to try and score. And there was a one-player one where you were just fighting gravity. Mm-hmm. And then there was stuff on the actual map that would explode, give you bonuses and all that kind of thing. So the game was okay. The port was all right. It had issues, but it was still, you know, it was my first game. So
right.
It was okay.
So you ported that to the Amiga?
No, I ported that from the Amiga to the Commodore 64.
Oh, okay. Right.
So it was written on the ST, then ported to the Amiga. And then I did the Commodore 64 version, and Steve Hammond did all the graphics.
Okay. This is maybe a little bit in the weeds, but why do you think the UK had such a fondness and just like a quick pickup for personal computers versus consoles, whereas, you know, in the States, even though this was kind of like the birthplace of computers, people gravitated more toward consoles here?
I think it's that kind of British wanting to tinker thing. They were also incredibly cheap. I mean, you could get a ZX Spectrum for £100. I'm not quite sure what that would be these days, but like consoles...
130, 140, 150
yeah.
maybe.
So, I mean, consoles back then were still pretty expensive, and you had to buy the games. As I said, when we went to this computer club, you copied all the games. So it was a really cheap way of getting into gaming. And then it didn't take long for a lot of folk to kind of go, you know, games are fun, and I wonder how they do that. And they started tinkering, because you've got keyboards, you can sit and program it. So I think that's just the British, you know, wanting to play with things and technology and stuff.
Right. Yeah, I definitely, you know, feel from reading things like Retro Gamer magazine and so forth that the legacy of British gaming history is very much like a couple of guys said, oh, we can do this and made games that, you know, may not have gotten a lot of circulation. But,
yes, definitely. But, I mean, particularly you look at some of the early Spectrum games, they were all pretty wacky. Some of my favourites, things like Manic Miner and stuff, very much have the Monty Python style humour, you know, just weird baddies and stuff moving about, and it was all just kind of part of what you'd expected. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So in your experience, you know, porting over Ballistics, what that was what it was called, right?
Ballistics, yes.
Yeah, okay. it's early, I haven't had enough coffee yet. Like, what did you kind of learn from the process of bringing that over to C64?
I mean, because I'd been programming for quite a few years, I knew most of the things that I needed to know. It was really my first commercial multiplexer for doing sprites and stuff. There was a lot of, because it was ball-to-ball collision, there was a lot of physics and maths in it, which I wasn't good at all. So I did learn some stuff to do with that. But really, most of the stuff you get from it is finishing something. Mm-hmm. It's always the hardest thing for anybody in games to do is actually finish a product and get it out.
So as much as any game has ever finished, really.
Well, yeah, I mean, but, you know, shipping it. Because you look at most people that tinker in the house and they'll play with various ideas and stuff, but it's that finishing something is the hardest thing to do.
Mm-hmm. So after Ballistics, what was your next project?
I did a port of Dave's Blood Money. And that went to Commodore 64 as well. I think that was probably my kind of, you know, big C64 game. That was great fun to do. It was what the 64 was brilliant at, doing shoot 'em ups and stuff. And I had just great fun just taking the most of the machine effectively then. So these games took about 6 months each.
Mm-hmm. So how long had you been working with C64 by the time you started doing these conversions?
Probably 2 and a bit years, I would think. I think it was, well, maybe not even that much. Maybe, yeah, a couple of years probably. So, but I'd been working with the Commodore Plus 4, which was a kind of spiritual successor, but not nearly as good. They kind of messed up when they did the Plus 4. It was more of a business machine, mm-hmm. but it still had 6502. So I'd been doing the kind of 6502 for, you know, a good 4 or 5 years at that point.
Okay. I know 6502 was a pretty common chip yeah. back then. Like, yeah. I think Nintendo used it for their NES. Yeah. So were you able to kind of branch out to other systems based
yeah,
on that experience?
After the I did Blood Money, Dave got a contract to do Shadow of the Beast on the PC Engine, mm-hmm. or the TG-16 as it was over
right,
there.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. So I started doing that. I think Dave really wanted to do it because it was a console. It was our first console. Mm-hmm. But he was a 68000 guy, so I got to do that. That was a 65C02, so it was a modified 6502. It was ballistically quick. Commodore 64 was 1 megahertz. The PC Engine was 7.5. So, I mean, imagine now if you went to a machine that was 7.5 times faster. It was just so fast.
Right.
And then it had loads of hardware to play with as well. Mm-hmm. So, but that took a long time, that game. They kept changing the design and it just kind of dragged on. It went from just being a cartridge game to a full CD-ROM game. It's one of the first CD-ROM games. So it took about 2 years, that one. A long time, especially back then.
So were you doing the conversion of Shadow of the Beast in tandem with the actual development of the source version?
Like no. Shadow of the Beast came out, it was probably 89, 90. So it had been out for a while, mm-hmm. And there was various ports. We actually got the port to do the Commodore 64 one as well, and another guy, Richard Swinfin, he did that. So I mean, the full thing was we were finished. We did get the full source and stuff to it, but we never used it. It was a bit of a mess, so we just looked at the game and copied it over, basically.
Okay. Well, you said that the version that you were working on kept changing. So that was
yeah.
that was more on the like the publisher side saying, oh, we want something different.
Yeah. I mean, we did a stack of graphics for it, and they weren't particularly happy. So Psygnosis ended up, I think, getting Martin Chudley of Bizarre Creations. He did all the graphics for it. And then they decided they wanted it to be a CD-ROM thing, so we ended up doing a movie player and all these intro sequences and stuff, and having CD-ROM music on it as well, which is very nice, I have to say. That was really, mm-hmm. really cool.
Yeah, I've played Shadow of the Beast on Amiga, but I don't think I've ever played the PC Engine,
PC
the
Engine
Turbo Graphics version.
Probably, I mean, it struggles with the parallax because it only has one play field. Mm-hmm. But it's probably the nicest version to play because the Amiga one just collision sucked. It was so difficult to play. But I kind of smoothed all that out when I was doing it, so it was playable, mm-hmm. effectively. So it's probably the nicest one to play.
It is an infamously difficult game yeah. to play. I remember, you know, I'd go to computer shops and I would see that game just like on demo
oh, yeah.
on the
it
systems
amazing.
Because, yeah, like it was yeah. just like, you know, at the same time I was playing Nintendo NES
yeah.
and there was just no comparison. I mean, it was a great sales tool, but, you know, at one point I sat down to play it and was just like, I'm good at video games. Why is this
yeah,
destroying
the collisions and hitboxes just were way off. That was just cruel, basically. So like I say, I fixed a lot of that in the version I did.
Mm-hmm. How much leeway were you given to kind of, you know, make changes like that when you did conversions?
I mean, the game had to be the same, but making things playable isn't something they really look at. If it plays better, they don't care, basically. So mm-hmm. as long as it feels nice and plays nice, then that's all they're wanting. Mm-hmm. So they didn't really want that kind of impossible playability for it, so they were all fine with that. But the game itself is pretty identical, really.
In moving over to the CD-ROM version, did you encounter any technical limitations or shortcomings? I know CD-ROM drives back in the day were pretty slow to load.
Yeah, I mean, we actually got a huge SCSI drive in. Now, in the past, about that time, SCSI drives or hard disks in general were about 20 to 40 megs. So we got this huge drive that took up two bays. You know, you're talking like an encyclopedia, couple encyclopedia thicknesses kind of thing. I mean, the whole office came around to look at it because we'd never seen anything that big.
That must have been thousands and thousands of dollars worth of hardware, too.
Oh, yeah, easily. And, you know, you'd be looking at it going, this can store a CD. That was just unheard of back then. 720 megs on this thing. So it's just huge. So mastering that, it wasn't a file system like you expect today. It had special tools for writing into sectors and stuff. So loading things was tricky and a bit slow. But, you know, it was okay. We were used to loading from disk from Commodore 64 days, which was slow. So we just kind of made the best of it. And it was fine. The, as I said, the machine itself was so fast that the game didn't really have any issues. It was really just the production part of it, getting all the graphics. And we had an animation player and stuff. That got complicated.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of experiences and lessons did you take from that project into, you know, future games that you worked on?
I mean, each game kind of contributes as you go forward, but there's there's very little you go, oh, I have to do that from now on kind of thing. It's really just that kind of wealth of experience that you get going forward. I did end up writing a full dev kit for the PC Engine. The one we got was terrible. So I hacked the dev kit and wrote my own debuggers and stuff for it, so that was much easier. And I've done that occasionally since.
Who distributed the TurboGrafx PC Engine in the UK? NEC did? Okay.
Yeah, I think that, well, we didn't get it in the UK.
Yeah, I was going to say.
No,
I,
it was only America and Japan that, under the PC Engine.
Okay.
And so we dealt with imports, basically.
Okay, so you were working specifically for the US market.
Yeah, it was the TG16 version that I was doing, and then it went to Japan as well.
Interesting. So you were not only, you know, working with unfamiliar hardware, but also working for like a different kind of television spec.
Yeah, yeah, it was the NTSC one, which is horrible. PAL's much nicer.
I hear that. I do like 60 frames per second, though.
Yeah, well, you get that now with PAL as well, so that's fine.
Okay.
But, I mean, the 50 frames a second gives you quite a bit more processor time, so we can do quite a bit more and still keep it smooth, so it's fine.
That's fine. It's interesting. There's always, like, you know, you deal with kind of these old specs, and people have very strong feelings about them.
Yeah, it was the color tint on the NTSC that was just horrible. Mm-hmm. We had proper color on it. That was what I really liked. Mm-hmm. So it was just nicer.
So did you have to compensate for the terrible color of NTSC as you were developing?
Well, no, because on the TVs we had, it literally had a dial for color tint. So users did whatever they wanted on their TVs back then. So we just picked a color that looked nice and went, okay, we'll do that, basically.
And hope that the Americans
could. Yeah, basically. I mean, because all the art was done on an Amiga with deep paint, they would just color it there. And then we'd tune the TV to what we knew it should look like, but we've no idea what the end users actually did with it. So.
Okay. I mean, I don't know, like that kind of thing, the quirks of analog technology are always really fascinating. I spend a lot of time these days trying to get old consoles up and running and get them into high definition with upscalers and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And like, there's just so much stuff I keep coming across that I had no idea, like sync on green and sync on luminosity and that sort of, like, it's such a headache. It's amazing that people were able to get anything done back then.
Yeah, yeah. Well, again, I mean, the PAL one was easier because we ended up with a SCART connector that had everything in it, and it was just much easier. Just plugged and go, really. NTSC with its the BNC connectors and stuff was awful.
Yeah, well, we were slumming it over here in the States.
Yeah, you were.
It's terrible. So did you do a lot more console development after that? I mostly know your work, you know, from PCs, but I feel like if you put together a dev kit for PC Engine, you got some use out of that.
Yeah. I mean, after the PC Engine one, we started doing Lemmings 2. So I did the SNES version of Lemmings 2, which was great fun. Couldn't use most of the hardware because Lemmings, by its nature, you've got, you know, 100 in a row, and you can only have like 16 sprites in a row on the SNES. So I was still abusing the machine a bit. That's
I definitely want to talk about that in terms of Lemmings, because it is such a distinctly PC oriented kind of game.
Yeah.
It feels very much like a game that was designed just to be played on PC, especially, you know, with a mouse.
Yeah.
But it showed up on everything, like every Game Boy had.
Yeah, Lemmings. We were seriously impressed with the Game Boy port. That was
done in house?
Well, no, we didn't do that one. We did Amiga and ST. The Amiga was the lead one. And then the ST and PC. And we also did Atari Lynx, ZX Spectrum, and Philips CDI. Those are the ones we did in the house.
Okay. So, yeah, let's talk about the genesis of Lemmings. I will say my own experience with Lemmings, my family got a Windows 3.1 PC in, I think, 1991, 92. Mm-hmm. I was in high school, and the one game that I bought for that system was Lemmings. So I was never any good at it, but but I spent a lot of time, you know, like trying to figure out the puzzles and getting frustrated and exploding everything and starting over and so forth.
Yeah.
But I've always been fascinated by just the overall style of that game, how you put so much personality into these tiny little guys who are like 5 pixels tall. It's really amazing.
Yeah. They ended up being 10 pixels, I think, with a bouncy hair. But
that's okay.
The original idea was to try and fit them in 8x8.
Mm-hmm.
So the initial kind of genesis of it was when Dave was doing Blood Money, he had this Walker character. Remember the Star Wars Walker with the two legs?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there was one of them in the game. And it was really nicely animated. The guy doing the art, Tony Smith, had made a beautiful job of it. So Dave wanted to do a game on its own with this Walker. So you were in the Walker shooting. And so he hired this artist, Scott Johnson, to come in and do graphics for it. So Scott started doing a little character that you could shoot with the Walker. But he did it about 16 by 16 pixels. Now, the Walker, while he was really big, that would have still taken him up to just below the cockpit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you remember Star Wars, they were huge. Mm-hmm. You know, you would be just above the feet.
Right.
So I thought you should really have something much smaller. So I went on DeepPaint and I kind of scribbled a wee guy to try and get him as small as I could, but still have some kind of, you know, it's still a guy kind of thing. I'd originally seen a game called Beachhead 2 on the Commodore 64 that had really nice animations of this little guy. Now, the little guy was actually quite large when I look back at it. But the animation was beautiful on it. And then also on the Atari ST Oids, which literally had 5 pixel high guys. So I figured somewhere in between you'd get something. So I did this animation of a wee guy and he was walking up a hill and getting shot by a gun and all that kind of stuff. And I showed the guys and they were all kind of falling about laughing. Because, I mean, it's the same reaction anybody else got when they first saw Lemmings was just all these guys dying. It was just great fun. So we then kind of added more.
Actually, knowing that the origin of the Lemming character harkens back to someone being shot
up
by a walker
definitely.
Explains a lot, really.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of part really came from Oids because he had the little, tiny little guys that you could shoot. You can kind of strafe across the ground and shoot, and they all kind of burst into flames and kind of died. So I'd done the walking frame, and then I'd done this kind of burning down frame and a big gun shooting them. So it kind of came from that. But they were all just kind of lining up to be shot kind of thing. So we all thought this was hysterically funny. And then we started doing other animations of them dying because we kind of realized that they're so small that you could get lots of frames of animations in these. Around the Amiga days, memory was still tight, but the sprites were quite large. So burning frames of animation was quite expensive. But these guys were so small, I mean, there were only 4 colors, so they would half the bit depth as well, that we could really just burn animations on them. And we thought, well, you know, that Roadrunner kind of thing where, you know, where the coyote just whacked every which way kind of thing, that's kind of what you could do with these guys. So we made a few other things on this animation and had them all kind of going, getting splatted. And then Gary kind of fine-tuned my animation, which was very kind of rough and stiff, into kind of what the actual Lemming was. And then shortly after that, I mean, this was only in the first month and a bit of having the office in 1989. So it was very soon after we opened the office. And then Russell did a demo of all these guys walking over the hill, just continually second round. He got the 100 Lemmings all getting drawn on a PC. Then it kind of fell by the wayside a bit as everybody else had other projects to do. And Dave was trying to get the Walker game going, but didn't quite manage it. So he went from Walker to another game called Gore that was a hack and slash that he ran out of memory on because it needed huge, again, it was a huge character, there's lots of animation, just burned memory. So he kind of put that to the side as well. And then he actually started on Lemmings. So, I mean, it took a long time to actually get it started, really.
Yeah, I mean, what's the time frame we're looking at here in terms of...
So the initial animation I did would have been August 1989. And then Dave would have started it probably in 1990, kind of mid-1990 kind of thing. I think it took about 9 months to develop,
mm-hmm.
9 months to a year. So, I mean, it came out in February 91. So, you know, it had a bit of time to kind of get going and stuff. The actual development of it wasn't particularly long because there wasn't really that much to it in terms of the skills and getting stuff. It was really getting all the levels, tuning it, and making it just that kind of playable mm-hmm. kind of thing that really took the time.
It's interesting, though, that, you know, like this kind of loose idea sort of hovered in limbo for almost a year, and then everyone kind of came back to it.
I mean, most ideas that happen will either happen from, well, for me anyway, from kind of just undirected, sitting playing with something, and then they'll kind of sit for a while, or they'll kind of throw down sticks and pick it up straight away. But it's not uncommon for these things to, because you'll be in the middle of something else, so you go, oh, I'll have to remember to do something with that. I mean, we had a huge stack of things that we could have done stuff with. Mm-hmm. I had a few Commodore 64 ones that never saw the light of day that I would have loved to have done stuff with, but you were busy doing other things. Sure. So it was really that Dave, the two games he was working on just weren't quite working out the way he wanted, that he thought, well, we'll give this a try.
So how do you go from a little guy being shot by a Star Wars walker to a puzzle game where you're controlling 100 creatures and trying to rescue as many of them as possible?
I mean, when we started, we kind of knew that you wanted to somehow kill these lemmings, because that was the fun bit of it. It's just, you know, they're dying all over the place. So it's not a big leap to go from you want to see them dying all the time to, well, you should probably save them, you know, because it's, you want to put traps around the level and they just keep dying and you see it. So if you just left it so on devices, they'll just all die in funny ways, kind of thing. So just letting them fall out and trying to save as many as you can is a reasonably simple step.
I mean, it's kind of, you know, like saying, here's the thing you want, but here's the thing you actually have to do, sort of force it, delaying gratification or something.
Yes, basically. Which is kind of why the nuke in Lemmings was so satisfying, because it's just, you're supposed to do it, but we'll just kill them anyway. It's fine.
It was a great frustration reliever, because some of those levels were really hard, like very devious.
It's odd, because, I mean, when we were doing the levels, by the time we got into really doing the levels, we were all experts. So you come up, there was three of us that really did most of the levels. Myself, Gary Timmins, and Scott Johnson. We kind of did the bulk of them. Dave got a couple in, and Steve tried to get some, but never quite managed. But the three of us would make the hardest levels we possibly could to try and beat everybody else. But it would only take a few seconds for everybody to go, oh, you just do this, and you click here and do that, and there you go, it's finished. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. So we had, when we set down to actually create levels for the game, Dave offered us £10 per level that got in, which seemed generous at the time, but these days it's not really. So we basically came up with a stack of levels that we thought, like, these are, you know, good hard levels. But we realized pretty quickly that they're incredibly difficult. We had Psygnosis testing them as well, and they were getting pretty good at them. But occasionally you'd get one where, you know, okay, this one took 3 minutes, this one took 5 minutes. And then there'd be scribbles all around that one going, this one took an hour and a half, kind of thing. That was really satisfying, obviously, to get. But the real key to Lemmings was that once we had these levels, we took them and then we made simpler versions of a lot of them, just by adding the odd skill in here or there to make it simpler. Because they were obviously tuned to be, you had that exact skill number to get out, and it was really hard. But if you added another builder, another basher, then it just makes it that bit easier. Mm-hmm. So we went through and made a whole load of simpler versions. And then Gary went in and made basically tutorial levels to introduce it. You know, just dig right at the start, where you could do nothing but dig and you kind of get out and it's easy. It was probably one of the first games to really do a tutorial through. And then he sat and he basically did a difficulty curve of all of them ramping up. I think once you got to the end of taxing, it was just kind of a free-for-all to just kind of throw levels in. There was a big battle to see who would get the last level, because that was supposed to be the hardest one. So Scott managed to get that with his Rendezvous on the Mountain. So we're all fighting for that one, but never mind.
Yeah, I liked the fact that there was a level select in there. So, you know, as you tried to work your way through linearly, you could be like, I'm getting pretty good at this. Or you get stuck and you could say, well, I wonder what it's like at the very end. Like, kind of like flipping to the last page of a book. But instead of like spoiling the story, it's basically just making you realize how absolutely terrible you are at this video game, how little you understand about its mechanics.
Yeah, I mean, Lemmings 2 kind of improved that with the 12 tribes. It had a little bit. Either because each one had its own little difficulty level, so you could kind of hop around a little bit better. But Lemmings 1, you kind of had to play through, because that's where the difficulty ramped. Mm. And we had folk, you know, we had 6 and 7 year olds playing it, getting up to a certain point and just enjoying clicking on things. We had older folk being able to play it as well. It was a very social game that folk would play with their parents. I think the best one I ever heard was Terry Pratchett used to play it, and he actually said, not only did he delete it from his machine, but he formatted his hard drive to make sure he never got it again. And I love that. Absolutely.
Was
brilliant.
That out of frustration or out of addiction?
Both, I think.
I heard that Pratchett was really into computer games. And he worked on or contributed to the Discworld games.
Yeah.
I think.
I mean, he had one of his books had the Lemmings control panel in it, apparently.
Oh, I didn't know.
Clicking and selecting. Okay. Yeah, I've not read it, but I've heard it's in there.
You know, I've read all of his Discworld books, so I probably didn't make the connection was like a reference to Lemming. But next time I read through his stuff, I'll have to keep an eye out for that. That's great. Talked about, you know, kind of the natural progression from you got to kill these guys to you got to save these guys. But the idea of having this sort of hands-off puzzle game where it's almost like a, you know, like a God Sim, like Populous or SimCity or something.
We were big Populous fans, so it was fairly natural. I mean, we had two rooms in our office that were kind of separated by a hall. So there was, you know, and we ran an old modem cable through and we played two-player games so you couldn't see the other screen. Mm. So we were big fans of Populous and Stunt Car Racing. So coming from Populous, this kind of off-hands control thing was pretty natural. While Populous controlled the landscape, we just assigned skills to individuals. But it was kind of similar in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, Populous is very much about, you said, the landscape, like changing the geography. And that is something you have to do with diggers. And we know when a lemming pops and explodes, it carves a little chunk out of the stage. Yeah. So
I mean, it's pretty influenced by Populous, really, when you get down to it.
But at the same time, you know, you do have this kind of puzzle element where you have X number of lemmings, you have to save Y number of lemmings.
Yeah.
And the challenge kind of evolves out of that.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, when we were doing the levels, it was, like I say, it was just coming up with weird and wacky ways to basically try and make it as tough as possible to get these out. Whether that be there's traps everywhere or you restrict the skills that you had, or you kind of use some of the quirks in the actual engine itself to that the player has to figure out. Things like being able to rescue a blocker. You know, if you dig underneath him, he falls and you can rescue him. So there'll be some levels where you've got to get every lemming out, even though you're using a blocker and you've got to get him back and stuff. Right. So it's just, you know, abusing it.
Mm-hmm. So the actual lemming skills, who worked on designing those? Was that a team
Dave
effort?
And Gary kind of did those ones, basically. I think they... Because of the nature of the way things walked, basically a lemming's collision is one pixel into the ground. So if you move to the next one and you can go up 4 pixels, down 4 pixels, anything more and you'll hop a little bit or fall. So that kind of limits what you can build. If you built a straight wall, they would just hit it and turn round. So you can't build a straight column. So the bridge was kind of a nice natural slope for them to walk up. So that was fairly easy. And then things like the bashers and the miners and stuff, they're, you know, again, a relative progression on what the landscape's doing anyway. I think only the digger was the one that you could kind of really get stuck on because that was just a vertical plummet, basically, so you have to be careful. But they were all just kind of trying to enhance what the landscape was, really.
Were there skills that were kind of left on the cutting room floor that you said, well, this, you know, this doesn't work or this makes the game too easy or too hard?
No, I can't remember any of them. I think the ones they came up with were just, you know, the ones they figured we'd get in and we used them all. Mm. I think Lemmings 2 was totally different. Mm-hmm. There were skills that we had to go back and put in levels because they weren't used.
Mm-hmm.
There was just way too many.
Yeah, that's something I'd like to ask you about because I do feel like, you know, the concept of Lemmings and the execution of it is, I don't know if I'd call it perfect, but it just seems complete. Like it is a fully realized concept that just, you know,
it just works.
It's there.
Yeah.
So obviously it was a big success and obviously Psygnosis was like, more please.
Yeah.
So how do you build on something that is, you know, functionally complete without just doing more of the same? I mean, I know there were expansions and everything, but like to actually build on that, to expand, to create something new based on this concept.
The Lemmings 2 stuff, Dave basically designed most of that. I think that there was a few things that were kind of a part that we needed. So more skills, I think, were always good. The vertical levels, I think, were great. And some of the tech that we did, so like you said before, it was really done for a PC or Amiga, so it was just loads of memory. But with all the consoles rising, SNES, Mega Drive, they were starting to take over from home computers. So we changed the tech to be more friendly to them. I think out of those, the vertical levels and the tech were the things that really made a difference. And I did like having the different tribes so that you could hop when you got a bit frustrated. That was nice as well. But I think the skills, they just went overboard on. You just didn't need that many skills. There were a few skill additions that were really nice. I liked the ballooner. I liked the super lemming. The archer was really nice, although the code in it was awful. But it was really nice. Some of the other ones, like Magna Booter, were fun, but kind of in there just, you know, for fun. The pole vaulter was silly. And there was just a whole load of them that were just never used. And they literally had to go back through levels and just go, you just need to put these in so they're used somewhere. So I think there was way too many skills added. It was obviously just we only had these ones, we'll need to add loads more, and they just went overboard on them, basically.
So you mentioned earlier that you did the Super NES conversion of Lemmings 2. So what were the challenges that were specific in particular to the hardware that you encountered, besides like sprite line limitations? Because I know Super NES, you know, you talked about the speed of the TurboGrafx, and the Super NES was like half that.
Yeah. I mean, it was a 16-bit processor, so it was a 65816 that was in it, but it was 3.5 megahertz. Mm. It did have some hardware, so you could have 3 play fields. And it did have a chunk of sprites, but you could only have 16 in a line, so you're really limited by it. So most of the stuff was done in software. Basically anything where there could be a stack of lemmings in a line. So you're talking blockers, walkers, dancers, probably fallers, just because of the number of them. I had to come up with a way of drawing them really quickly in software on a 3.5 megahertz processor. And I wasn't quite able to get the full thing, so I only had 80 lemmings rather than 100. And when it scrolled, I had to pause because I couldn't scroll and draw the edges and do the whole game as well. But that actually ended up helping the SNES because you were on a controller.
Right, so, yeah, I was going to say, it seems like it would make the game a little more manageable.
Yeah. So I did come up with a way of drawing into this four-color screen. I had 2 16-color screens and a four-color screen. And I stacked the characters in the four-color screen vertically, so I had strips, and I could just move a lemming up and down and draw in the strip. The 65816 also had a really cool feature where you could move what's called the zero-page area. The zero-page was a point on the 6502 where everything was just that little bit quicker because it didn't have to read the high byte of the address. It was also always down at zero. So you had between 0 and 255 addressing. So it was a byte less, so you got a cycle quicker. But you could move where that was in the SNES. So I moved that to the base of the graphics to just get, you know, an extra cycle out of each bit I got, and then so I can draw it in. And then that screen was transferred up every kind of game tech. So I had to jump through a lot of hoops on the SNES to do it. I was able to use some of the sprites. Some of the skills would be normal sprites. All the traps were sprites. So things like water and stuff were sprites. Everything else was basically a bitmap screen kind of scrolling around. And then I put in a parallax background for just to make it look pretty, basically. So it was a really tricky kind of game to get on that machine. But the tech we changed for Lemmings 2 to go character-based rather than bitmap-based made it much easier. It was still hard, but it was much easier.
Mm-hmm. So have you had any involvement with the Lemmings franchise beyond Lemmings 2?
I did a bit of Lemmings 3 work. I think I did the installer and helped them out with the audio part of it because they were struggling a little bit. Aside from that, no, it was really just one and two I was kind of mainly involved in. Mm-hmm.
What do you think of Lemmings' legacy? Like, what do you think its place in video game history is?
I think it's a shame it's not really been taken forward because at the time it was definitely up with Mario and Sonic and stuff. You know, it was that big and Psygnosis owned it and then Sony bought it and they've not really done anything with it. You could certainly do more with the character than just what the original game was, but they just seem to churn out the same game over and over again, which is a shame.
Well, there were some weird attempts to do other things, like the 3D Lemmings I don't think worked that well.
I did like the Revolutions one. That wasn't too bad, but it was still basically the same game.
And there was the Lomax spinoff, which was at that point, it kind of isn't Lemmings anymore.
No, but I think the characters themselves you could certainly do something with, but I think you need to keep them quite small. And I think that's what most of the newer games aren't doing. They're kind of losing that kind of small and millions of them. That's really what you need.
Right. I mean, I feel like it might be challenging with, like a 4K TV to have Lemmings that are, six pixels tall.
About 10 years or so ago, I had a reasonably powerful machine, so I decided to see what modern graphics cards could do with it. Mm-hmm. The original Lemmings game ran at 70 frames a second, so a frame every 3 frames. So using that, I was able to get a million Lemmings on my PC, and that was 10 years ago. So, I mean, that was a lot of things. So, put explosions in them and bounce them about and stuff. It was very cool.
Right.
And I think that's what you need.
I feel like it would take a long time to finish a million Lemming level.
Well, it depends if you're trying to kill them or not. You could flip it on its head and just go, yeah, they've breeded now and you've just got to nuke them or something.
Right. 100% kill levels.
Yeah.
Interesting. So there is potential for Lemmings in the future.
Oh, yeah.
If Sony wants to pick it up and do something with it.
That's it, yeah.
All right. Well, Mike, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome. It was great
meeting you. And, what are you working on these days?
I've just started my own kind of indie thing. I used to work at Yo-Yo Games for about 9 years doing Game Maker, but I've recently left, so I'm about to start doing my own little games.
Okay.
We'll see how it goes.
Well, where can people find you and your work online?
I'm on Twitter at MDF200. You can kind of find there. That's where I frequent most of the time at the moment. My games are still a bit off, so there's nothing really to shout about there yet, but Twitter's probably the easiest place to find me.
Okay, great. Well, thanks again.
Okay, no problem.